From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
Today I'm delighted to welcome Claire Reed, a non-resident senior associate with the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, and a law partner at Arnold & Porter. Welcome, Claire, to China this week as a distinguished visitor to the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Claire has more than three decades of experience in handling international trade strategy, negotiations, and litigation. She spent 6 years as the Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for China Affairs in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, where she was responsible for developing and implementing U.S. trade policy toward China, Hong Kong, Macau, Taiwan, and Mongolia. And before that, she served as the first Chief Counsel for China Trade Enforcement at USTR. Today, we'll be speaking with Claire on issues related to U.S.-China trade relations, a topic, of course, that's been brought up extensively in the presidential campaign. Claire, thank you very much for joining China in the World podcast today.
It's my pleasure.
I mentioned that you started out in USTR as the Chief Counsel for China Trade Enforcement. That was actually at the end of the Bush administration. And I wonder if we could just start out, if you would tell us a little bit about that position and why, what that position did and how you got started there.
Sure. The dates go as follows. I came in August of 2006, and I was in that role until April of 2010, when I shifted over to being the assistant U.S. trade rep for China.
So you were 2 years in the Bush administration before...
Right.
The Obama administration took over. Yeah.
Right. And what had happened was there was recognition that in 2006, China had been in the WTO for 5 years. And there had been a transition period that had been established for China to actually meet its obligations. And the transition period was largely over. And there was a very significant sense that China, as a major participant in the world system, needed now to be held fully accountable.
Sure.
To meet the rules. And I think the administration at the time was looking for ways to really focus on this issue and get resources really targeted at moving things forward with regard to bringing WTO cases against mm-hmm. China in areas where China was not meeting the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a partner in doing international trade law in a major Washington law firm, and a friend of mine reached out to me, and I had actually a background way back in the day from having a fellowship coming out of law school and the Fletcher School.
Mm.
I got a fellowship to study mediation, and at the time, back in ancient history, we were not able to go into China, so I went to Taiwan. And it actually was the year that we de-recognized Taiwan.
Oh, interesting.
China,
1979
to 1980. So I was in Taiwan studying mediation as an alternative form of dispute settlement. So I had Chinese, which I had acquired at Harvard during the time that I was doing this joint degree between Harvard and the Fletcher School. So anyway, so I got this fellowship, and that yeah. started me off. So I had an abiding interest in China that had come yeah. from that background. And so I'd been almost 25 years in, you know, being a lawyer in a law firm, and I had always been interested in public service. I'd actually been in the State Department legal advisor's office when I was a baby, law student. And so it had always been in my mind. So this was a great opportunity, and I was focused laser-like on...
Yeah.
Finding areas where there were WTO rules at issue, where China wasn't meeting its obligations. And so I was involved with quite a large number of cases against China, probably had a role in about nine major WTO cases against China.
And in your perspective, I mean, was this helpful in enforcing the standards that China had signed up to during that period where you put forth 9 WTO cases against China. What kind of impact did this have?
I thought it was helpful. First of all, one of the things that no one knew at the outset was whether China was serious about living inside the institution that it had signed up to,
sure.
Which means do you respect the rulings that come down if they come down against you? Do you make changes in your policies when it's pointed out that the policies, the laws are not proper?
Right.
And
or inconsistent,
or
I
inconsistent
guess,
with right, exactly,
yeah.
Inconsistent with WTO rules, and China really responded by and large very constructively. So laws were changed and practices were amended to come into compliance. Now, you know, it's complicated, and
mm-hmm.
some of the cases have probably lingered longer than others in terms of China's implementing its obligations. China also settled a number of the cases, I think, because they recognized that it was an open and shut case, frankly, and they didn't want to have a bad record. So
the optics were bad.
Yeah,
for China.
So the settlement was preferable for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the good news about that was that when they settled for 100 cents on the dollar, and we wouldn't have, as USG, we would not have accepted a settlement that was less than that.
And I take it this must have been good experience to have going into the job as assistant U.S. trade rep on China.
Well, it certainly was. And I had a close relationship with the ouster, as we call him, at the
mm-hmm.
time. And we worked very closely together. And I ended up doing a lot of negotiation because we negotiated a lot of settlements. So it was very interesting to see what it was like to be at a table when you had a broad array of issues where you didn't have that rifle shot approach for solving the problem of here's a WTO rule, you are not meeting it, you need to meet it, you know, or else we're going to have a problem together.
Mm-hmm.
And that in some ways, when I shifted over to becoming the assistant U.S. trade rep, now I had the entire array of issues in front of me where I could not use...
You could take a narrow approach, you had to take a more broad approach.
Right, and not only that, but the solutions to those problems were not as evident
mm-hmm.
because maybe there wasn't a WTO rule, or maybe there was a WTO rule, but if you thought about whether it would be constructive to take a case, it wouldn't necessarily work out that
mm-hmm.
well.
And you did this job for 6 years, is that right?
Well, I was in the government from 2006 through the end of 2014. So my total time was more than 8 years,
mm-hmm.
But split between the two jobs.
And, you know, we're coming up on the end of the Obama administration, and you've spent a good deal of time, some in the Bush administration, but a big chunk in the Obama administration. And I wonder if you look back over the 8 years of the Obama administration, how would you sort of characterize the issues on trade with China? What are some of the legacy items that have come out of that? And looking into sort of the next administration, where do we go from there?
I think the Obama administration focused on WTO cases with China that were of major significance systemically or structurally. So that was an important dimension of what they were trying to do. One of the most important sets of cases, I think, that were brought against China were the cases related to export restraints that China was putting on some natural resources where it had a dominant dominant world market share.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, it could affect world market prices, and it could also use its resource richness as a way to try to force companies to come in and locate in China in order to be able to get the resource, rather than freely exporting the resource to the rest of the world. And of course, the WTO rules say that in the normal course of things, you are supposed to freely trade, so you're not supposed to put restraints on your exports
mm-hmm.
any
mm-hmm.
more than you're supposed to put restraints on your imports, that
mm-hmm.
freely trading is best for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very important and was an important principle, and also important to a couple of industries, including steel and aluminum and some other lesser known industries as well. And in a series of cases, because there's only so much that you can do at a time, we focused on a number of different raw materials and natural resources that China was hoarding, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up, you know, having impacts on high tech industries as well, because these were resources that were including rare earths,
which sure.
was yeah. a big one that people talked about.
Absolutely.
So the effort to look at that, the effort to look at the actions of state-owned enterprises, the effort and to see where there were China monopolies that were distorting markets, where
mm-hmm.
China was supposed had committed to opening its market
sure.
to other suppliers. Those are important, also important cases. So that was one useful thing that occurred. The other work that was done was to amplify the strategic economic dialogue, the
mm-hmm.
so-called SED,
right.
that had been set up by Hank Paulson in the Treasury
right.
Department, and to add into it the strategic, a separate strategic component, which was then you created the strategic and economic dialogue,
mm-hmm.
which... What the Obama administration did then was add high-level activity by the State Department and, to some extent, our military, our defense, you know, came into that to have conversations on strategic issues in addition
yes.
to the economic issues.
Right.
Now, my competence sits on the, you know, the trade and investment
sure.
side, so I was
yeah.
still firmly on the economic side of
right.
of the fence. But I will say that adding dialogue with China on the full range of issues that affect our two countries and having there be high-level conversations
yeah.
where it's not just a random conversation, but there is sort of an expectation that you are going to sit down and seriously review issues
yes.
together at a specific time, and that at the end of that specific time, from China's perspective, you hopefully are not going to have a blow up where
yeah.
you leave mad.
Right.
That creates, I think, a useful kind of pressure
mm-hmm.
to sit down and try to understand each other and make progress on things. You don't always make progress,
right.
but the conversation is important.
Yeah, I agree with that. The forcing function nature of having that. Of course, I was in the Bush administration when SED, Strategic Economic Dialogue, was created by Hank Paulson, and I think it was very useful at the time and drove, you know, with vigor much of the economic agenda between the U.S., United States and China. I was in the Obama administration for 6 months and was part of the effort to sort of modify that to make it both strategic and economic. And I think it was the right change at the right time, elevating not just the economic discussions, but also the strategic discussions led by the Secretary of State. And you mentioned the military, and I think that's absolutely key to try to get the military in this discussion. Now that we've got 8 years of the Obama administration, there's a lot of discussion about how do we make it more effective going forward. You know, in recent meetings with the Chinese, a message that I'm hearing from the Chinese is we hope that we don't see the U.S. side get rid of the SNED because it's not as effective as it could be, but rather let's keep it because it plays that role as a forcing function, and we know we have the predictability of meeting once a year and discussing the range of issues. The Chinese side has been saying as of late, let's really focus our energy on making it more effective. Do you agree with that? And if so, what are the kind of things that a new administration might sort of take on to make that body more effective in dealing with issues and making progress on issues?
You know, it's very interesting because when the SED came into play, the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade was already in place.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a mechanism that's co-led by the Secretary of Commerce and USTR
yeah.
and has as its interlocutor a vice premier, who's the same vice premier who's the interlocutor for
Wang Yang, yeah. mm-hmm.
for the SNED, the economic track
right.
of the SNED.
Right.
Okay. So one of the reason I mention that is because I think for U.S. business, they really appreciated what the JCCT could do in terms of solving concrete issues
mm-hmm.
that needed to get taken care of. including systemic issues.
Right.
And one of the sort of questions that arises is, what is this? What is the purpose of the SNED relative to the JCCT?
Right. Right.
And I think that there's been a tension between those to some extent, although I think they are complementary, and I think they're complementary in the sense of both being these, you know, action-forcing events because you have a mechanism for actually meeting and you have a predictability about what's going on. I do think you can end up with meeting fatigue and sort of, you know, progress fatigue because when you're talking about major issues, it's very difficult for you to make progress every 3 months on major issues.
Yeah.
So I think you have to be careful that you don't proliferate dialogues because I think you can actually create a burnout effect where nothing happens anywhere.
Well, I'd be interested, how do you perceive the, because often the JCCT is just in advance of the SNED by
they
several
split,
months.
Right? They,
yeah.
they tend to There's, bookend the year.
Yeah.
In good years, the SNED occurs in sort of the May, early June time frame, and the JCCT occurs November, December.
And so there, I often hear people say, well, they're going to tee up issues at the JCCT for the SNED, but I don't think they were designed in that way, were they? I mean, they're to deal with separate issues
well,
as far as I
think. I think they were conceived by different people for different sets of problems, and it turned out there's an overlap. Because I think at the beginning, Paulson's concept was that we needed to have overarching strategic, that's why it was called the strategic economic dialogue, strategic conversations about long-term issues, where we actually sit down and we're not trying to be transactional about something that's happening now, but we're looking together at areas where we can work together or at areas where there are broader issues that we really need to be sitting down and talking about.
Yeah.
But I think it took about 15 minutes after he announced it for, I believe he was up at Congress very shortly thereafter at a hearing. And there were a number of very specific problems that were going on with China at the time. I don't, it might have been currency.
Right.
I can't remember what it was. And they basically said to him,
"We want to see progress.
We want to see progress, right? Through the
SED at the time,
right? We want. We need progress, and we need you. How can you possibly take half of the cabinet and, you know, take their time for 2 days or 3 days or 4 days and not get something?" Get something done.
So this pressure then to have deliverables and to show progress sort of pushed kind of the emphasis to have specific concrete outcomes. And that then, as a result, it sounds like had, you know, the JCCT and the SED and now the SNED are sometimes then working on the same thing, probably because in large part of this pressure to have results. Is that right?
Well, I mean, Well, in a practical way, right? Now, one mechanism is better suited than another. So, for example, when you are doing macroeconomics and you're talking about excessive savings rates in China, that is not something the JCCT talks about or deals with.
I see.
So that is something on a macro level that needs to be handled there.
I see.
Obviously, military does not come up.
Yeah.
Climate does not come up in the JCCT unless you're talking about something specific like environmental goods, or you're talking about, you know, having when you have refurbished goods and you're trying to get them imported and China has barriers. So there could be specific problems that exist. So there is, they're not, it's like a Venn diagram, you know, they're overlapping circles as opposed to actually being right on top of each other.
Interesting.
So I think it's a creative tension, though, and I think they're both very useful.
Mm-hmm.
What I do think is important is for there to be clear conduits up to the top leadership in China that's making the decisions in both cases.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever the mechanisms are that Xi Jinping is using now to be able to make decisions on strategic and economic issues, those interlocutors on the Chinese side need to be tied in directly to that for it to be effective. And for us to be able to actually be willing to put the kind of resources that we put into it. And that's similar, I think, in the JCCT side. It's going to be very important that that occur too, because if the retail side of our relationship is basically in in disarray or you've got a lot of dissatisfaction, mm-hmm. And you don't have progress through the JCCT on the what are short and medium term issues that are concrete mm-hmm. issues that are occurring in our yeah. trade investment relationship, that's a serious problem.
Just to be a little more specific on the S&ED currently, the counterpart to the Secretary of the Treasury is Vice Premier Wang Yang.
Correct.
Lioha, of course, plays a very important role on economic issues here in China as the head of the leading small group on economic affairs, but is not in the S&ED, correct?
Correct. I mean, one of the challenges for the U.S. government, I think, has been that it has sometimes been difficult for U.S. government officials to speak to the actual policymakers, because when they're party officials, from the Chinese perspective, they have said, you are a government, you will speak to a government official, you will not speak to a party official. But with the shifting of responsibilities inside the Xi administration, I think an understanding of the need for more flexibility is important. Mm-hmm. I also will say one other thing, and that is, I believe that U.S. cabinet members have a lot more power than Chinese ministers do. And so I think there is also an asymmetry, a mismatch in terms of the meetings. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with meeting with a Chinese minister. But the truth of the matter is even though Chinese vice premiers have multiple portfolios, our cabinet members have as much power, and these days in the yes. Xi administration, they have more power than right. than the vice premiers do.
Right.
So I think there's also an importance in the next administration to make sure that the levels are right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final thing that I would say about the S&ED in particular, because there are multiple cabinet members involved,
yeah.
is there is a potentially large value to having there be candid conversations between counterparts on particular issues. But if what happens is that all the work is done and you only end up with a set of talking points read in a large meeting, right. that can be very frustrating.
Right. Now, more of a dueling monologue.
Yeah,
right?
dueling
monologue. Than an actual discussion.
Right. right. But the difficulty then is that I think we need to understand China. So if a Chinese official is sitting at a table with a number of his peers, there are constraints potentially right. on what that Chinese official can say and how it can be said. There are not similar constraints on the U.S. side. A U.S. cabinet official who's in charge of, name that subject, energy, commerce, trade, will feel free to say what it is that is on their mind and right. engage in the discussion. Right. But the constraints on the other side are much more significant.
Mm-hmm.
So then we have to find ways for there to be constructive interaction. If for this to work, we need to have this broad base of subject matter that's at the table. And I would make the argument that we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater
yes, right.
by reducing, just have three people in a room. Because if you only have three people in a room, then you're only going to talk about two things. And if the range of issues that China and the United States have that they need to talk about is wide, which it is, then I think we're better off trying to figure out how we get those good mm-hmm. discussions
mm-hmm.
set up rather than narrowing it
mm-hmm.
to a smaller room where you know you might be able to have a candid discussion, but only a few people.
So this is counterintuitive, actually, because if you're thinking that you're not having candid discussions that you need to have because Chinese interlocutors have constraints because of the others around the table, then you would decide, well, we need to go smaller. But you're actually saying you need to broaden it out and have more at the table because of their portfolio.
Well, no, maybe what you do is you have more breakouts.
I see, more breakout
right?
sessions.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, if we understand that in a large meeting you will not have candid conversation on their side,
yes.
then you need to develop whatever the forum is for you to be able to have candid conversation.
Right.
Now,
right.
the other difficulty, of course, and this is, we can't do anything about this,
yeah.
is our cabinet members are very busy. Their officials are very busy. And you get your best candid conversations when you have a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult to build those relationships.
Yeah. Well, these are all very good ideas. And I think, you know, the next administration really needs to look at this. And I agree with you not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think it SNED and the JCCT have been useful for them. They can be certainly improved and, you know, find ways to become more effective. I would actually argue that the fact that they're on the calendar and they're there every year is plays an important role in terms of predictability and knowing that you're going to have a time where you can sort of focus on these issues.
I totally agree with you. Europe, during the time that I was in government, had some significant difficulties for several years even getting meetings set with the Chinese. Well, if you can't meet, you can't solve a problem.
Yes.
So it's important to understand the value of having those mechanisms in place.
One of the things we're hearing now from the Chinese side, in advance of the next administration coming in, some of the messaging is that we ought to perhaps do the same kind of regular meeting structure with our presidents. That while President Obama and President Xi have met often, it wasn't part of a regular meeting schedule. So the Chinese have a regular meeting schedule, for example, with the Russian president. President Xi meets on a regular schedule with the president of France and the president of Germany. But there's not a regular meeting schedule for the U.S. and Chinese president. And one of the things we're hearing now is a suggestion on the Chinese side that they more, you know, make them more regular, like the JCCT, on the calendar every year in the same time frame. Which is an interesting idea.
It is an interesting idea. What I guess I would be, what I think we have to do, hopefully, would be to connect them to these mechanisms so that we're not creating additional times where the really serious work is done. In other words, if you split them off, then there's a risk that the only time that they get super serious is when the two presidents are meeting, and we wouldn't want that.
And you can't put everything on the two presidents. It's not possible.
Right, cannot.
So.
Right.
Well, it's been delightful to talk to you and to hear about your experiences in government and USTR and your views on these really important issues. And Claire, we welcome you back to the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for doing the China in the World podcast.
It's my pleasure.
That's it for this edition of Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thanks for listening and be sure to tune in next time.